Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. America's first Gilded Age in the 19th century had huge inequality and huge resistance to it. Americans fired up in the streets, pushing back hard. This time out, in this century's Gilded Age, barely a peep in comparison, says my guest today, labor historian Steve Fraser. He's thought a lot about why. It goes to the heart of our time and where it leads. This hour on Point, where's the fight in our age of stark inequality? You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Should Americans be in the streets over this time? Why aren't they? Or are you? Tell us. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Steve Fraser. His big new book is The Age of Acquiescence, The Life and Death of American Resistance to Organized Wealth and Power. Steve Fraser, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for inviting me.
What happened to the fight in the American way?
That's a tough question. I don't know if my book has successfully answered it. I spend a lot of pages trying to figure out why, but if I was asked to single out one reason, it's this. Back in the day, during the first Gilded Age, there was the enormous resistance you refer to. And I think the reason there was is that there was a broader anti-capitalist culture that informed large stretches of America, both agrarian and urban industrial America. And the reason there was that kind of anti-capitalist culture, which not only affected working people and farmers, but artists and writers and novelists, even presidents and journalists and clerics, is because industrial capitalism was something very new in the 19th century and shocking to people who had come from earlier different ways of life with a different set of values, whether they had been independent farmers or peasants in southern and eastern Europe or handicraftsmen or small businessmen serving local economies. This new system of industrial capitalism driven by market relations as the dominant value in society was new and also extremely threatening existentially. These ways of life were being driven out of existence. And so people were both desperate, but also more than desperate, they knew that capitalism was not necessarily their fate. It wasn't inevitable because they or their parents and their kinfolk in Europe and so on were aware of other ways of life, other moral values that might inform the way people got on together. And this gave them a kind of capacity to imagine something different, not one single thing, but a kind of non-capitalist future, whether that was called by the Knights of Labor, the Cooperative Commonwealth, or by a broad stretch of the Protestant religious world, the social gospel, or whether it was called socialism, or whether it was called the anti-monopoly movement, as it was by literally millions of small businessmen and consumers. All of them envisioned in one way or another something other than what they faced. And I know this is a long-winded answer, but I think today and during our second Gilded Age, we lack that sense of alternative, which has to be there, I think, to inspire concerted, durable mass resistance. Because those of us who've grown, come of age in the last 50 years, take capitalism for granted, and particularly in the last 40 years, assume that the market is the be-all and end-all of the way not only the economy should be organized, but the way we should ground our life, that a kind of relentless competitiveness, a race to the top, if you will, the imperative that things be efficient, that economic growth is the ne plus ultra of all values. These things we take for granted now, and they've been hammered home to us by by the mass media, by both political parties. The Democratic Party largely abandoned the populist fervor that gave it strength during the New Deal years and before that. The Republican Party has and the business community has been well organized over the last 30 or 40 years to drum home the lesson that that the market is a kind of religion. It's a kind of a credo that it is equivalent to freedom. The free market and freedom are the same thing, and that has captured the imagination of people. And then, of course, there's the question of the new economy we live in, which is a very precarious and dangerous one for people, and undermines their ability to resist in a variety of ways. But I'll stop. I don't want to take up your whole show.
No, it's terrific.
Sorry.
It's terrific. I mean, the thing is, maybe Americans have come to take the value of the market for granted for a reason. I mean, after all, and we will take time to go back to the 19th century. It's kind of mind-boggling to see how fierce it was then. You write, in the first Gilded Age, it was full of sound and fury. The second, ours, seems to take place in a padded cell, and we'll look at that. But maybe Americans take the value of the market for granted for a reason. After all, in the 19th century, it was still about mules and outhouses. The standard of living has come a long way since then. Maybe Americans look at all that competitiveness and say, this paid off. Maybe not today, maybe not right now, but in the 20th century, we got a lot wealthier.
Well, here's the strange thing about that. Actually, the first Gilded Age, despite all the hardships, the exploitation, the material deprivations, the technological unsophistication, if you will, compared to today, actually witnessed a steady, slow rise in the general standard of living. Isn't that odd?
And no, yet, I don't think it's odd, but even
it
was outhouses and shacks for an awful lot of Americans in the 19th century.
Yes, but those outhouses and shacks were perceptibly to many people being replaced by whatever, indoor plumbing, if you will, or refrigerators and so on, telephones.
Well, industrialization did create wealth. I mean, no one's arguing that. It was distribution that had people so upset, but they got some.
No, yes, that's what I'm arguing. What I'm trying to say is that despite that, there was enormous resistance to the domination of the economy and of our political life by business and business-allied interests. Despite that obvious material improvement, despite those technological marvels, there's a common belief, I think, that many people share, that the worse things off are, the more likely you are to get resistance to them. But I don't think that actually is the case. I think it's much more complicated. And let me just finish my thought.
Yeah.
The second Gilded Age that we're living through has actually seen, despite its various, information technology, a steady decline, very slow and gradual over the last 35 years, of the standard of living of millions of Americans. Millions of them are in a we are now behind most of Western Europe in the rates of upward social mobility in this country. For 30 or 40 million Americans work for a living, but work for poverty level wages.
So our forebears went into the streets in the 19th century, even though their standard of living was rising.
That's what
ours
I'm arguing,
falling.
Yes.
And your argument is we're still i.e. the 99%, if you want to put it in Occupy Wall Street terms, are sitting on our hands.
Yes, I am making that point, which I think is a counterintuitive one, which says that, you know, it's not only about material things that bring people into the streets or cause a minister in a church to say that the worship of mammon is sinful, you know, and a society guided by mammon worship is a society that's morally and spiritually ill. It isn't just material things that do that, and I think this counterintuitive notion is important one for us to grasp. There are other things going on, and including the first thing I pointed to when I began to talk, this lack of alternatives, which very much informed that 19th century, even as people's lives were improving. You know, let me make another point if I could. You know, when a peasant came from Sicily to America, there's no question that his life in America was better than it was in Sicily. That's one of the reasons he came. But nonetheless, and I'm not picking out peasants in Sicily. I'm using that as an example. Millions of villagers from Europe who came from very, very difficult circumstances came to America and found their life very difficult, but in strictly material terms, probably a bit better than the lives they had left behind, which was the whole reason they came.
Yep.
And then nonetheless, they engaged in these incredible strikes. I mean, waves and waves of strikes rolled across the country for 30 or 40 years, you know, and so on.
Okay, so they came. Maybe it's because in those days, all the stuff that Marx put on the table was still sitting on the table and not tested yet. This was before revolution in Russia.
Yeah.
This was before the great and widely perceived now to be failed socialist experiments of the 20th century. Maybe that's the heart of acquiescence.
I think that's one of the reasons. There's no question. But let me say, first of all, that socialism per se was never a big movement in America. You know, it was far larger than if it even exists today in America. It was far larger.
But the ideas were out there. I mean,
well, the idea of something other than capitalism,
yeah.
Not necessarily socialism.
Well, you talk about a cooperative
right.
this or a communal that,
yes,
and you're at Marx's
right.
doorstep in a hurry.
Yes, but it's not the same as saying, well, the failure of the Soviet Union, what it turned into, is why things collapsed. Long before and after that was happening, for instance, take the Great Depression, all right? The Bolshevik
yep.
Revolution is already 20 years old by that time, or exactly 15 years old. The purge trials are on. Communism is not a hot topic, a popular topic in America. Nonetheless, what you have beginning in the early 1930s are maybe I should stop here.
We'll take it. Hold it right
yeah.
there, Steve. We'll come back.
Yeah.
Steve Fraser's new book is The Age of Acquiescence. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Occupy Wall Street protesters there in New York City in 2011. Banks got bailed out. We got sold out. But my guest today, Steve Fraser, says we live in what he calls the age of acquiescence. His new book is that title, The Age of Acquiescence, The Life and Death of American Resistance to Organized Wealth and Power. Look back to the 19th century. Americans were in the streets in the first Gilded Age in a big, big way, striking, protesting, really raising mayhem there about it. This time, it's like we're in a padded cell, he says. He joins us today from New York. It wasn't just Occupy Wall Street. I mean, there are others who have been out there. Here's a woman taking to the megaphone as fast food workers gathered in a McDonald's in New York earlier this year to protest low wages.
We cannot build our families on $7.25 an hour. We cannot build families. We cannot have healthy schools if we can't afford to feed our children. We cannot have a healthy streets and safe areas if we do not have an equitable paycheck.
And here, students at UC Berkeley in November protesting tuition hikes, student debt, a big deal. Okay, there they are. But in general, says labor historian Steve Fraser, America's history of opposition has mysteriously withered away. Steve, I know you're in the middle of a point, but a lot of people are jumping into this conversation. I want to let them. West Des Moines, Iowa. Stephen, you're on the air, Stephen.
Hi, Tom. I'd just like to say that I am angry. I am more politically involved than I've ever been in my life. I'm the poster child when it comes to reinventing yourself every 2 to 3 to 5 years to find another job and or career. What I see as far as in my neighborhood and in my metro area are a lot of people working 50 to 60 hours a week and toting their kids around, you know, getting them to their extracurricular activities.
Yeah.
People are tired. People are tired. And only because my firm let me go as cost cutting. They were owned by a private equity firm, and I was part of that trimming it down.
Yep, you and a lot of others. Steve, let me ask you though, Stephen, if you're tired, are you really ready to go to the streets, or are you going to, I don't know, turn on the?
I since I've I'm in between opportunities right now.
Opportunities. That's the way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I am, like I said, I've become very, very politically involved, and I'm ready. I'm ready to go. I don't know how to express the anger that I feel without, you know, sounding like some kind of crazy person. But it's not just me talking to my friend, my kids' friends.
Yeah.
Parents, activities and stuff, none of us are making it.
Tired of hopping, ready to do something about it. Steve and I appreciate your call. One more right here in New York. Springville, New York. Jeremy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to say, quick, two little points. I agree with the last gentleman. A lot of people are tired. All right, they're too busy to take to the streets because they have to worry about working their minimum wage job. That's pretty much it. There's too much as well as the entertainment purpose. So basically, I'm blaming laziness on it as well. You know.
What keeps you too busy to do something about it, Jeremy? What?
Well, I can picture the single mom who's trying to work, who's trying to support her family.
What about you? What about you?
Me, sir. I make my own money. So I am happy with where I'm at. And I will continue to work hard to get my own American dream, as well as I am completely free of debt. So that is the other thing that holds us down. Like, after you go to college, you're already in debt, $60,000, $70,000,
$80,000.
Yeah. You go out, the bank will front you a house, you're another 100 grand in debt. They're making you work for the rest of your life just to own the options.
Do you have a good job, Jeremy?
Brian?
Do you have a good job?
I'm a disabled veteran, sir.
Okay.
And then on the side, I go to auctions, participate in eBay, Craigslist.
Right.
I refurbish hot tubs.
Okay.
Basically, anything that has value, and I know the value of it.
Yeah.
I work.
So you're putting it together. One way or another, you're putting it together. Jeremy, I appreciate your call. Steve, you get a little taste of what's out there right there. I want to roll forward, but let's roll back first to make that 19th century protest real. I mean, I don't think many Americans really have in mind what went on there. You got this. You say during the first Gilded Age, and what you're talking when to when, Steve?
Well, I call it the long 19th century, from not long after the Civil War through the New Deal, so technically into the 20th century.
Okay, you say millions of farmers, handicraftsmen, shopkeepers, fishermen, small property owners, not to mention millions of ex-slaves and dispossessed parents from the steppes and parched fields of Eastern Southern Europe became the country's original working class. They were swept up, often enough against their will or with little other choice, into the process of capital accumulation happening at the forges and foundries and engine houses and packing plants and mills and mines and bridges and tunnels and wharves and the factories in the field that were transforming the face of America. This reprocessing of human raw material into wage labor, that's what we were all about. Of course, that Gilded Age was built on industrialization, industrial capitalism. The second, ours, was built on finance capitalism. Describe what went on in the streets and union halls in those years, from after the Civil War through the end of the century.
Okay. I would like to say something about your callers, but no, let me do that. First of all, let's look at the countryside, which people don't think about much anymore. There was what was called then the People's Party or Populist Party, which mobilized literally millions of independent farmers in both on the Great Plains and in the West and in the South. And in the South, to some degree, a movement which embraced both black and white sharecroppers, tenant farmers, and independent farmers. This was an enormously powerful movement which lasted for a decade, elected dozens and dozens of senators, governors, congressmen, state legislators, mayors. It was a whole way of life which swept the country, calling for sometimes the cooperative commonwealth, calling for graduated income tax, which was unheard of in those days, calling for nationalization of the railroads and public utilities. So you had this massive agrarian movement in America during the first Gilded Age. Mm-hmm. Then in urban America, in industrial America, you had an endless series of strikes of the most significant kind. They weren't the strikes we're used to today. That is, they were, but they were something different. It wasn't merely that Carnegie's steelworkers went on strike or that Vanderbilt's railroad workers went on strike. When they did, these strikes became mass events so that the surrounding community and countryside and sometimes towns far removed from the actual site of the strike itself would pour out in support support of the strike. This was then called a mass strike. Shopkeepers would sympathize with the strikers. There would be all kinds of farmers. Even the farmers in the populist movement would aid the railroad strikers who were striking against Jay Gould's railroad out in the Midwest.
And this was tough stuff. I mean, they would come out ready to rumble. There would be armed men sent out by... certainly the police, and more than that, sent out by the industrialists to confront them. Here they are.
Yes, this was what many people thought of this as an imminent second civil war, just happening a decade after the first civil war.
I mean, you had 16 people killed in 1877 in a strike in Pittsburgh. 1886, of course, the bomb in Chicago's Haymarket Square. 6 police officers went down, 4 workers there. New York, same year, 1,200 strikes.
Yeah, well, think of this. Imagine this today. It was commonplace in 19th Gilded Age America for armed worker militias to parade through the streets of our major metropolitan centers so as to announce to their enemies, that is to say their corporate employers, that if they were attacked, they were prepared to fight back. Now, imagine that today. It's unimaginable.
But I'm not sure I want to. Is that what you're proposing?
Well, no, I'm not. No, I'm using it as an example to describe to you and your listeners how fraught relations were at that moment and for a long, long... Of course I don't want that. Who would want that? But the point is that's how prepared people were to stand up against what they saw as their enemies. And it wasn't only their industrial or economic enemies. They saw the power of organized wealth as a political problem, as subverting all the main institutions of democratic life. The Senate was known as a millionaire's club, was called that by the populist and anti-monopoly movement of that era. Even presidents inveighed against the power of organized wealth. Theodore Roosevelt decried malefactors of great wealth. Woodrow Wilson ran for president in 1912 on a campaign that focused on the power of the money trust, that is to say, what then in those days was thought of as the circle of white shoe investment bankers in New York that not only controlled the large capital flows in the country, but also were subverting democratic life because of their inordinate power. Franklin Roosevelt, most famously, of course, talks about economic royalists and Tories of industry. And can you imagine a president saying this today? He said of those people, he said, they hate me and I welcome their hatred.
Malefactors of great wealth. Bring it on, he was saying.
He was saying, right, to the economic royalists and Tories of industry, bring it on. That's exactly right. That kind of language, I mean, our language has been purged of much of the vocabulary that formed this culture back in the 19th century for a variety of reasons. But when you cleanse a language of those kinds of images and metaphors, you also disarm people. It's like your first caller said. He said, you know, I don't want to seem like a crazy person, so I don't know what to do with my anger. And that's very telling. We're not supposed to talk about class struggle. We're not even really supposed to talk about class because America is dedicated to the illusion that we're not a class society. You know, the wonderful comedian George
Collins. Well, we weren't so class structured for a long time. It's getting harder to make that case now, but for a long time, the 20th century is pretty good. You can make a good case.
Yeah, and you know why you could make a fairly decent case, although you and I might differ about how good a case?
Yeah.
That's because of all that resistance, which then resulted in what became a kind of civilized capitalist order of things with minimum wages and maximum hours and the right to belong to a union and Social Security and unemployment insurance. All of that is the result of the concerted long-term agitation, organization, mobilization by working people, reformers, intellectuals, social workers, which culminated in what we now think of as the New Deal order of things and which has been systematically dismantled over the last 30 or 40 years. That's why people could with some credulity say, well, we don't really have a class society. We're all middle class. I don't think that's true, but you could say it with some...
Compared to today.
Yes, that's right.
And now, says Steve Fraser, the country is taking it laying down as it's gone to the 99% and the 1% as Occupy Wall Street would have it. His new book is The Age of Acquiescence, The Life and Death of American Resistance to Organized Wealth and Power. Marcia, in Providence, Rhode Island. Marcia, you're on the air.
Thank you. To pick up on what your speaker has been saying, class warfare has become a pejorative that the Republicans have been using again and again and again over these decades to blame anyone who's discontented and seeking a better life, a fairer chance. They are told that it's class warfare that they're after. And at each presidential nominating convention that the Republicans hold, they repeat this mantra of, you must not be jealous of anyone else who's better off than you are. They worked hard.
Marcia, if I may, I mean, if we can avoid class warfare, it's a better thing, isn't it? If we
The unions have been crushed by the Republican Party. They deliberately set about to crush the unions with these right-to-work laws and so forth, and they've taught people to believe that it's wrong to be jealous, that wanting a better way life for yourself is just a form of jealousy of those who have made it, and that your best, the best way into the future is through a lottery system, where if you're lucky, you'll get a lot, and no one should be jealous of you for having
it. Well, I'm sure they're talking about hard work. Marcia, I appreciate your call. Steve Fraser, I mean, class warfare comes with a lot of costs, and we have seen that in revolutions in the 20th century. On the other hand, if you talk against class warfare but allow class distinctions to explode in scale, there's some deep irony there, Steve.
Yeah, there is a deep irony, and I have to say that class warfare is not produced by the people who are being exploited, oppressed, denied perhaps what might be called their fair share. It's produced by those who generate a system that then makes people say, well, what is going on here? And then in the past, resist. So without class warfare, there's no weekend. Right? No weekend.
Didn't have it in the 19th century.
They didn't have it.
Just work and work, 8-hour day, forget it.
You know, there used to be signs posted on factory gates which said, if you don't come in Sunday, don't bother to come in Monday. Right? No weekend. If you don't fight back, no weekend. You don't fight back, no unemployment insurance. You don't fight back, no minimum wage, and so on. So,
but we've got weekends now, and unemployment insurance, and a minimum, very minimum wage.
Yeah, look at that minimum wage. Isn't it appalling, maybe not to you, but to me it is, that you can have 40 to million working Americans making poverty. They're full-time workers, right? They're working in canneries, in call centers, on construction sites, landscaping, in hospitals, etc. They have no way to defend their own interests, and they make sub-minimum wage. Do you know, and there are
endless
reports.
No, I think it's gross, but when you have a minimum wage and unemployment and these other things we have, maybe it puts just enough floor in there that people don't go to the streets.
There isn't enough floor. That's the point. There isn't enough floor. That's why people, you know, you think there's enough floor.
I didn't say enough, but just enough that they don't go to the streets. You have to admit they're not in the streets. That's your whole point. Why do you think there's a padded cell?
Well, I don't think it's for that reason. I don't think it's because they're making a comfortable minimum wage.
I didn't say comfortable.
I think it more has to do with what your callers mm-hmm. talked about. I think one is that they're working all the time. Mm-hmm. I think both your first and second caller referred to the fact that he works, the first guy worked 50 hours a week.
And be ready to hop to a whole other job.
You're living in precarious circumstances. There's no security at your job. Increasingly, most jobs do not come with pensions. They do not come with vacations. They do not. Moreover, that creates a kind of situation which is deadening, exhausting, and militates against getting into the streets and fighting back.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. My guest this hour is labor historian Steve Fraser. His new book is The Age of Acquiescence, The Life and Death of American Resistance to Organized Wealth and Power. He looks back to the first Gilded Age, the 19th century, Americans in the streets, deeply into action to resist what really offended them. They won a lot with that eventually. This time, second Gilded Age, pretty quiet, he says, as if we're in a padded cell, and he's thinking about why. Politicians talk about it in all kinds of ways. Republican Senator Ted Cruz announcing his bid for the presidential nomination this week at Liberty University, saying Americans have to come together and create change. Ted Cruz.
This is our fight. The answer will not come from Washington. It will come only from the men and women across this country, from men and women, from people of faith, from lovers of liberty, from people who respect the Constitution.
Tea Party man Ted Cruz here, Senator Will Elizabeth Warren. This is 2012 Democratic National Convention. Charlotte, here she is.
The system is rigged. Look around. Oil companies guzzle down billions in profits. Billionaires pay lower tax rates than their secretaries. And Wall Street CEOs, the same ones who wrecked our economy and destroyed millions of jobs, still strut around Congress, no shame, demanding favors, and acting like we should thank them.
Political voices in our Gilded Age. Steve Fraser joins us from New York. Rhonda's on the line from Clear Lake, Iowa. Rhonda, you're on the air. What do you think?
Got to agree with Steve in Des Moines and the following caller. After him, we're self-employed for about 30 years. We are working 7 days a week just to pay our student loan, which is $658 a month for one child at 7.9%.
Ouch.
Our health insurance, which is through the roof with a $5,000 deductible. Oh. My husband's a contractor. I'm a self-employed realtor. We don't have time, and I guess I feel like it takes money to make money. So the people with money are going to have to fight this cause because we can't do it.
People with money are going to have to fight the cause. Rhonda, don't hold your breath, but I appreciate your call. Mark in Shawnee, Oklahoma. What do you think, Mark?
Well, I mean, I have a daughter that's a waitress with two children and a brother-in-law who's a second-tier management at one of the top five oil companies in America.
Okay.
I see the Gulf.
Okay.
And I'm infuriated by the politicians who make noise and do nothing. But the bottom line is people are too comfortable to take to the streets. I was listening to a show on NPR yesterday, and a lady who lives in a place where they now have the highest minimum wage in America took her increased wages working at McDonald's and bought an iPhone 6.
I heard that, too, and it struck me, Mark. But what do you take from that? I heard the same thing, and it struck me. What do you take from it?
I take from it that, in the main, people are too comfortable to feel motivated to get uncomfortable taking to the barricades. It is not the same condition that the greatest generation faced in the 30s in the Great Depression. It is not that condition at all.
But listen to Rhonda in Iowa working 7 days a week, $5,000 deductible on super expensive health care, $650 a week to pay for student loans for her kids. I mean, that doesn't sound too bearable.
But it isn't a high enough percentage of the population in that jackpot that's going to actually get motivated to take action. The daughter of mine, who works as a waitress,
yep,
gets housing assistance, Medicaid, food stamps. She lives reasonably comfortably, even though she's working for tips.
Mark, I really appreciate your call. I really appreciate it. Let me take it to Steve. Steve, there's a couple of calls back to back. And what do you make of this argument? Plenty of pain, a lot of pain, but not enough pain to get people out and bothered.
Well, I guess by definition, it's true. That is to say, the premise of the book is that people are not out there, and and so why are they not out there? Well, something in them restrains them. Is it their level of material comfort? It may be in some cases. After all, consumer culture, which was only beginning to develop in the late 19th and early 20th century, has come a long way since then. and we spend a great deal of our fantasy life immersed in consumer culture, and consumer culture offers a kind of private emancipation from the various difficulties we face in life. You have a choice. Say to cite your first or second caller, your mm-hmm. first caller, I think, mm-hmm. you can band together with your fellows to demand that the things change and that the rich and powerful give up some of their wealth and power, or you can go into debt, you know, and indulge those very legitimate needs for whatever they are, a house, college education, etc. But debt becomes an enormous burden as well as a kind of form of private individual release for the moment.
Buy a mocha culotta and forget about it.
Right, or take out that subprime mortgage and get that home that you've always desired instead of taking on the banks, which are making it so difficult and have made it so difficult for the country as a whole to prosper over the last 30 years. It's an alternative, and maybe many people true. But I think for some people, it's also a question of fear. Look, we have 12 million undocumented immigrants in this country doing a lot of the dirty work that makes this economy function. But if you're one of those people, or even if you're not, if you're documented, but the boss has enormous power. That boss is in violation, I guarantee you, because there are endless studies that show this, of every wage and hour law on the books, whether it's about minimum wage, overtime, the number of hours. So what are you going to do? Are you going to stand up and report him to the local labor department or whatever the local agency might be? What might be the cost of that? Well, maybe you lose your job. Who's going to, or you get deported, or your family is placed in difficult circumstances. I think we can't underestimate the degree of fear that plays a role in making people acquiesce. I think that's an important part of the picture. If we look at the way, for example, the right to organize, which was a basic right won by the labor movement and was part of the New Deal during the 1930s, has been abrogated, violated, and so on systematically, so that the National Labor Relations Act is no longer a powerful piece of legislation. Employers violate it at will. They are then maybe taken to court, say by a union or by people who want to unionize. They then have an armada of lawyers who can drag out that case for months and years. Meanwhile, the workers who brought the suit need to make a living. They leave the plant, or they were fired to begin with. The union that they were organizing dissolves because there's nothing going on while this court case is pending, and so on. So there are 1,000 ways in which employers, in which the workplace is a black box in which a kind of employer tyranny exercises itself, even in the face of laws that are supposed to prevent that.
Steve Fraser, standby. Chris in Nashville, Tennessee. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I everything I was about to say was just said. I'm a Teamster in Nashville. I work for a truck line. We were asked back in 08 to give back 15% of our wages, and they froze our pensions. We were allowed to vote on it. Everybody voted, and the company won the vote. The vote was yes. And the reason for that is because at that time, the economy is on the skids,
yep.
And the company used fear, just as Steve just said. And the concessions that we gave were supposed to end this year, but they came back to us in November. James Welsh, he's the CEO of YRCW.
Okay.
He is a tyrannical, he's a power-hungry, greedy.
What happened, Chris? What happened? What happened?
He asked us, he told us that, sure enough, the banks have come and they've said that they need the concessions to last until 2019. So we were allowed to vote. We voted no. And then 2 weeks of propaganda and fear and threats came, and they said, well, lo and behold, we're going to give you a chance to vote again. And sure enough, when they voted, they got what they wanted. The reason they got what they wanted is because of debt. The people who I work with are so far in debt that they're subject to that fear. And they voted yes because they're afraid of losing their jobs, because if they lose their jobs, all their goodies are going to be taken
away. Chris, where do you think this goes? You're a union man. You're a Teamster. You see what happened in your country. You look at the your company. Look at the whole country. Where does this go, Chris?
Well, it continues to get worse and worse and worse until, as you had on your show one time, a guy, I can't remember the name of the book, but I do remember the content.
Yep.
He was the zillionaire who said they're coming for us with pitchforks. And you brought up the thing that was going on in Ferguson, which was going on. And and until, if this continues, there's going to be hell to pay. And Steve made the comment, you know, somebody said that they were afraid to say exactly how they feel because they didn't want to appear to be a crazy person. Well, I think that some crazy people are the only ones that are going to change this. And I do believe, though, it's going to have to get a lot worse before it gets better because men, don't have the guts to stand up and say enough is enough because they're afraid. And from what I've seen, they're afraid that their goodies are going to be taken away and then their families are going to suffer. And so they acquiesce and are subject to all the fear-mongering and the threats that are put down to them.
Chris, we got it. They acquiesce. And there you are right at Steve Fraser's doorstep. Yeah, we had Nick Hanauer on, one of the early investors in Amazon, very rich guy, saying we got to change with the coming force with pitchforks. But we've had lots of voices, rich and poor, and you've got plenty of rich who say who don't go. Peter Thiel we've had on. Big California investor going in a different direction entirely from Nick Hanauer. Steve, lots of response online here as well. Paul says, after this on Twitter, after seeing many of the labor gains and inequality evaporate in recent years, people are resigned to inevitability of inequality. Bill says, wonder if uproar in the streets will come and be extremely visible very suddenly and fast, like same-sex marriage acceptance. Rajesh says, businesses should realize they've had a great 40-year run through lobbying, deregulation, union-busting, globalization, SCOTUS, Inc., second tweet, it's time for citizens to get theirs. Stretching to point of desperation isn't good for anyone. Not sure if Biz realizes, cares. And finally, Jim says, reasons for the passive climate and how they mesh could fill the week of conversations. Start with myself. Here I sit tweeting, not out talking. And talking might be the least of it. Chris in Nashville says it will go on. And sooner or later, there will be hell to pay. Do you agree, Steve, or not?
Well, who knows? I'm not a prophet, but I do agree. And I'll give you, I am is a historian, and I'll give you a historical reason for why I agree. If you took a snapshot of the country in 1932 at the depths of the Great Depression, what you would see was a deeply demoralized, cynical, disarmed, inert population full of a hopeless one.
Sort of 1930 here.
Mm-hmm. 1930, 1932, just say on the eve of Roosevelt's election, right? If you took that same photograph 2 years later in 1934, you wouldn't recognize the country. What you would see was a general strike in San Francisco, a general strike in Minneapolis, a nationwide textile strike. You would see sit-downs in the factory occupations in the rubber plants. Soon you would see factory occupations of General Motors. You would see farmer labor parties spreading throughout the Midwest in America. You would see farmers organizing in the Farm Holiday Association to demand better prices for their milk. You would see them actually holding what they called penny auctions in which they would come to a public auction of a dispossessed farmer and buy up the land for a penny and return it to the farmer. In cities, you would see landlords evicting their tenants and their neighbors taking the furniture piled on the sidewalk and putting it back in the apartment.
It sounds like a different world, but as you say, then it changed in a hurry. Carol, in Austin, Texas. Carol, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am in the exact same position as Rhonda, but you spoke with earlier.
Yeah.
And then we're told to rise up. In my town, just outside of Austin, Texas, a population of 60,000, my police force has armored personnel carriers and military-issue weapons that they were gifted from the military. University of Texas has armored personnel carriers, military weapons. Well, how are we going to rise up against that?
Well, you don't have to rise up literally in arms, Carol. What about just getting out in the street and protesting?
Well, we see what happens to people that protest, and I can't compete with military vehicles. My police force trained to be a militia.
Yeah, Carol, we've got it. Our time is short. Steve, what do you say? Heavy stuff come out.
Well, let me tell Carol this. I don't minimize anybody's fear of facing off against armed personnel carriers, but let me tell you this, Carol, that in the 19th century, every major corporation, or if not every, many, had their own armed militias, private armies. Do you know, in the big cities of America, there are now, to this day, armories. Those armories were built in 1877 and thereafter in the wake of great railroad strikes. You know why they were built? So that the next time workers struck and marched through the streets, they could shoot them down with Gatling guns. And I do not exaggerate. That's why those armories were built. Nonetheless, people continued to march through the streets and face off against that kind of might. Even in the 1930s, and this was the subject of Senate investigations by the La Follette Committee, all the major corporations, DuPont, General Motors, U.S. Steel, Republic Steel, all had their own arsenals. Serious arsenals with which to resist unionization. They all had fleets of spies that honeycombed union organizing efforts. So people managed then to face up to that. Perhaps they can again today.
In the Washington Post Review, the headline is this. Talking about Steve's book, he says, in the age of acquiescence, Steve Fraser asks how Americans became weenies. It's a lot of really fascinating history. It's easy to forget what our forebears have been and done. Steve Fraser, you bring it back to life along with big questions about us right now, today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Steve Fraser, author of The Age of Acquiescence, The Life and Death of American Resistance to Organized Wealth and Power. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.